In healthcare, as in life, language really matters, but some terms more than others seem to often misunderstood. In my clinic, the term that I explain more commonly than other is palliative care. Why is it so, and why does it matter? I'm Bogda Kozwara, and this is Supportive Care Matters. My guest today is Dr. Thomas Smith. Dr. Smith is a professor of oncology at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine, director of palliative medicine for Johns Hopkins Medicine, and the Harry J. Duffy Family Professor of Palliative Care. He's a medical oncologist and a palliative care specialist with a lifelong interest in better symptom management, communication, and improving access to high-quality, affordable care. Dr. Smith, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much, Bogda. It's great to be here and to be sharing this moment with you. I'm looking forward to this.
I'm so looking forward to this discussion. And I'm going to start with some basic definitions. You are a palliative care specialist, and palliative care is a topic that often gets so incredibly confused, both by patients and healthcare providers. So perhaps let's start with some definitions. What is palliative care?
I like Diane Meyer's definition. She's the head of the Center to Advance Palliative Care. And I even have it up on the screen. Palliative care is specialized medical care for people with serious illness. The type of care is focused on providing patients with relief from the symptoms, pain, and stress of a serious illness, whatever the diagnosis. The goal is to improve quality of life for both the patient and family. And palliative care is provided by a team of doctors, nurses, and other specialists who work with the patient's other doctors to provide an extra layer of support. And palliative care is appropriate at any age and at any stage in a serious illness and can be provided together with curative treatment. That's pretty long, too long for an elevator speech. So I just say palliative care is expert symptom assessment and management, open and honest communication, and medically appropriate goal setting.
So palliative care really fits very well with supportive care, right?
I don't really see too much difference between the two. I know as a field, we go back and forth because some people think that palliative care is too scary. Usually it's the doctors who are afraid of palliative care rather than most patients who, at least up until a few years ago, had no idea what palliative care was. And it fits with survivorship because we really see a lot of the same symptoms. You know, speaking as a cancer survivor myself and somebody dealing with recurrent cancer, you know, I give people four cycles of taxotere, Cytoxan after their lumpectomy and radiation therapy, and they have a difficult time of it. But then when they're done, I say, thank you. Have a nice life.
Yes.
But they're bothered by fatigue, nausea, depression, anxiety, PTSD, demoralization, all the things that palliative care specializes in. And palliative care really does symptom control. But I see part of my job as a palliative care specialist to get people out exercising, to do weight control if possible, and to resume as normal life as possible. And that fits really well with survivorship.
So is the problem that we just not very good at and handling the language? You know, I can think of examples when patients come to my clinic and say, oh, I was told that I am palliative, which sounds like a sort of a value judgment of them as a person, as opposed to definition of the sort of care provided. Do we need to be more particular with how we use words in cancer care, in supportive care, and in how we relate to people?
We do need to be careful of words because many people associate palliative with hospice care at the end of life. Radiation therapists, I think, have an advantage because before they turn the machine on, they have to flick a toggle switch to palliative or curative and document in the chart what they're doing. So I think the palliative part scares people because they don't know what it means. So I'll often ask people, have you heard of palliative care? Most people will say no. I'll say, well, it's a team of healthcare professionals, including nurses, doctors, physical therapists, nutritionists, psychologists, psychology nurses, nurse practitioners, doctors who work together with your regular cardiologist or your regular heart transplant specialist or your regular leukemia specialist to make sure that your quality of life is maintained and to reduce the stress on you and your family. And when you phrase it that way, I mean, who wouldn't want it?
Who wouldn't want it? But let's be a little bit provocative and just turn it the other way around. If we create a field of palliative care providers who have the expertise in providing good supportive care, are we getting the cancer clinicians off the hook and saying, you don't have to worry about supportive care because there's this wonderful team that will do it for you. You could just keep on giving chemotherapy and focus on anti-tumor effect. Is that not a good approach?
I think that's a moral hazard of providing good supportive care or palliative care alongside oncology or alongside heart transplants or left ventricular assist devices or leukemia treatment. There are some oncologists who are already very good at palliative care. They listen well. They explain in common terms what's going to happen as best we can predict. They explain what the options are. They explain the side effects and the good effects. I would bet one third of oncologists are already pretty darn good at that. One third are awful at it. And probably they would do better if they just turned that aspect of care over to their palliative care colleagues. And I think one third are in the middle where, like me training many years ago, I got no exposure to palliative care. I mean, I didn't, you know, the term wasn't even coined yet. And I think those people are very trainable. I mean, we work very closely with our oncology fellows and our young attendings to get them comfortable having serious illness conversations. We divide it up into primary palliative care and secondary palliative care. Primary palliative care is something I think every healthcare professional should know how to do. Manage pain, manage nausea, manage dyspnea, assess a patient's understanding, help them establish what reasonable goals of care might be. But then you get into secondary palliative care. I'm not sure that I want my cardiac surgeons prescribing methadone. And if there's a really bad conflict in the family, you know, what do we do with Aunt Maud on her third aortic valve replacement and she's not getting better and she's got a fungal infection? I think, number one, a lot of surgeons don't have the time or the interest to do that, particularly the time, because it does take time. I would just as soon that we meet with the surgical team, meet with the oncology team, the leukemia, the transplant team, and say, how would you like to work together as a team to help manage this very difficult situation? That's what I call secondary palliative care.
So what you're really describing is what psychologists often refer to as a stepped care model, where there's sort of the basic step is really something that you would expect from everyone involved in healthcare delivery, but the more complex situations would require complex expertise that might come just from palliative care. I quite like it because I sometimes would be in a situation where I might be working with on the ward with junior doctors who would say, well, this patient needs some pain relief or nausea management and we'll call palliative care. It seems to me that we should be pretty good at managing the basic introductory pain relief and nausea management. But perhaps if that is complex and we are not really managing very well, that's where you sort of refer to a more specialized service.
That fits with my model as well. Our daughter happens to be a gynecologic oncology surgeon at the University of Pennsylvania, and she's gotten very, very good at palliative care. Sort of rub, maybe the apple didn't fall too far from the tree, but it takes time and it takes expertise if you're going to do it right. For instance, I still talk to oncologists who don't know that olanzapine is the very best nausea drug ever invented. And in fact, we just rewrote the American Society of Clinical Oncology guidelines for anorexia and cachexia to say that olanzapine, 2.5 or 5 milligrams at night, is the drug to use for anorexia and cachexia because it helps people with their appetite and helps them gain weight and help get more strength back, as compared to mirtazapine, which in the largest randomized trial didn't work at all, and megestrol acetate, which helps you retain a little bit of water, but doesn't do anything for overall survival, doesn't increase muscle mass, etc. And you'd be surprised at how many of my oncology colleagues don't have any idea that those guidelines have changed.
So this is very interesting because it sounds to me that palliative care and oncology care really need to work very closely together. And you are in a way quite unique because you are both. Should we be having more oncologists who are palliative care specialists as well, or perhaps vice versa?
Rami Sedholm and I looked at the number of combined training programs in the United States about 2 or 3 years ago, and there are exactly zero. None.
Oh, dear.
Whereas there are a lot of geriatric and palliative care combined training programs. Both of those are one-year programs, so it's a little bit easier to swallow taking that extra year. But I think there are probably 5 or 6 combined oncology and palliative care programs. And I think that's good for people who have a strong interest in both. But I don't think you need to spend an entire year to learn how to have a serious illness conversation, how to talk about advanced directives, how to talk about code status, how to use olanzapine for nausea and anorexia, how to manage carcinomatosis, things like that. You can look up a lot of that in UpToDate or any textbook. So I'm just thankful that our oncology fellows now get a lot of this and have rotations with us. So they spend at least 2 weeks with the team, and they'll spend a day with the chaplain, they'll spend a day with the social worker, they'll spend a day with other members of the team. We do have an experiment going on right now, sort of a natural experiment. We have 3 oncology teams in our 250-bed cancer hospital, and one of them has embedded palliative care that co-rounds, as opposed to waiting to be called. When that's been studied in other situations, the rate of consultation goes from like 16% of seriously ill patients get consulted for palliative care, and up to 40 or 50%. And there are some advantages to that. It doesn't make people die sooner. Actually, inpatient palliative care doesn't influence patients' rate of death or length of survival. Outpatient palliative care, on the other hand, from the meta-analysis of the 3 largest randomized trials, shows that there's actually a survival benefit, particularly if started 3 months or before the person dies. But you have a chance then to get to know the family well. You have a chance, if you're working with the oncologist, to understand things from the oncologist's point of view. And sometimes the best treatment for their palliative symptom is to actually treat the disease.
Yes, yes.
That's certainly true in congestive heart failure, certainly true in interstitial lung disease, pulmonary hypertension. I can think of a handful of patients that I've seen over the years where I was actually able to suggest a newer, different regimen for them and, you know, get their lymphoma back into remission for 2 or 3 years.
Which is a very good palliative intervention, isn't it?
It is. You know, the best palliation is getting rid of the cause.
Yes, yes. What you're really sort of describing here is mutual understanding and sort of close proximity and close interaction, isn't it? Where you don't necessarily have to have a formal training program, but perhaps joint rounds, joint meetings, exposure to each other's work, so you kind of understand how the other team works. In Australia, it used to be that oncology trainees were required to undertake a palliative care rotation, and palliative care trainees were required to take an oncology rotation. It is no longer mandatory, I believe, which is a shame, because I think that having an opportunity to see how the others work is really the way of understanding the possibilities of how one could do better.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. And it's not just oncology. It's serious pulmonary illness, it's cardiovascular disease, it's nephrology, it's neurology. Having an understanding of what the patient and family want and what's available to them is very important. I think palliative people sometimes underestimate the power of, say, a second-line treatment for multiple myeloma, or third-line treatment, and now a fourth-line treatment, or a first- or second-line treatment for hepatocellular carcinoma. We think, oh, they're just making them sick with these diseases. But in fact, people live longer and probably live better. And if you ask most people, they really don't want to die. One of my colleagues, Tom Finucan, calls it the deep and abiding desire not to be dead.
It's a good term. Very persuasive.
I think palliative care people should understand from the point of view of the patient that we as patients are willing to put up with a lot more than the average person. I mean, I studied this in lung cancer about 15 years ago, and there are multiple studies in Japan, England, United States, various systems in the United States, Italy, and lung cancer patients were willing to undergo chemotherapy for a 1 to 10% chance of living longer. Their nurses and doctors, on the other hand, and these are oncology nurses and oncology doctors, they would demand like a 50% chance of living longer and better. So your perspective changes when you're looking death in the face.
I want to pick up on that because, of course, you mentioned that you are a cancer survivor and you have almost single-handedly revolutionized how we look at the concept of survivorship in the context of metastatic cancer. You, together with Terry Langbaum, published a paper in the New England Journal of Medicine in 2019 called Time to Study Metastatic Cancer Survivorship. And that really sort of opened the door for talking about patient experience and all these issues and the need for looking at what are the needs of cancer survivors who live with metastatic cancer. Tell us a little bit more how this idea started and what has happened since.
Well, thank you for giving me credit for helping to start it along with Terry, who unfortunately is now passed away of her fourth cancer about 4 years ago. Cancer survivor with recurrent prostate cancer myself have had loads of complications from radiation and chemotherapy. And I sometimes think my healthcare providers didn't take my needs very seriously. When I said, I think I'm getting depressed, one of my doctors said, well, I've never had a prostate cancer patient get depressed before. When in fact, the data are very different than that. And when I couldn't breathe because I had pneumonitis from bicalutamide, it took me about a month and a half to convince my pulmonologist that, you know, maybe there's something going wrong with your lungs. Whereas a medical oncologist, I knew that it's a class effect of the AMID drugs. I mean, that's why some of the drugs carry a box warning about liver fibrosis and lung fibrosis. I think it makes the most difference in people whose prognosis has changed dramatically in the past 5 or 10 years. So I have lung cancer patients with targetable genetic changes who are doing very well, you know, with anti-ROS1 drugs. They're now drug one, drug two, drug three, drug four. You can take out a brain met, you can take out another brain met, you can stereotactic on another if it happens. And those people used to live a year and a half, and now they may be living 10 years, 12 years, 15 years. Makes the discussion about prognosis more difficult, but it also means that they have the cumulative toxicity of every single drug regimen. And that's where I think metastatic survivorship is different. The same with multiple myeloma. You know, when I started medical school back in 1974, myeloma patients lived 3 years and then died. And now many of them, some of them are cured with either transplant or they remain in remission for a long time. If you read the ASCO Post or the ASCO Evening News, it seems like every 3 months there's a new drug that works for multiple myeloma. And I see that in my patients that they're living longer and longer and longer. I mean, I don't treat them. I treat their neuropathy and their fatigue and their depression and their adjustment disorders and their anxiety and family stress. But there's this cumulative toxicity, both mental and physical, that I don't think we as oncologists recognize very well.
Yes, and we don't really address it because in a way, as oncologists, I recall that when I was training in oncology, it was very much a sort of a field that looked at the tumor as if it existed in a vacuum, meaning there was no comorbidities. You know, you either got rid of the tumor or the patient died. There wasn't a bit in between, but now there is, and there is so much more complexity to it, and perhaps we're not that well equipped in addressing that complexity.
One of the things I stress with both our palliative care and oncology people is to use some measure of patient-reported outcomes at each visit. Ethan Bosch has shown that if you give people an iPhone or you have them log in once a week on the computer with a symptom checklist, they use PROMIS, that group lives 6 months longer than those who didn't.
That's good if it were a cancer drug.
The average overall survival absolute benefit is 6 people out of 100 at 1 year, 2 years, 5 years, and 6 years. And as you say, that's better than a lot of cancer drugs that have gotten approved by FDAs around the world. He repeated the same study in France with lung cancer patients. One group got their regular care at a very good center. The other group got their care but logged in once a week to report their symptoms. And there's a nurse at the other end of the line who, when he or she sees something spike, calls them up and either fixes it over the phone or brings them in for evaluation. And that absolute difference in survival at 2 years was 12 people out of 100. 12 people out of 100. You know, we would die for that in any other lung cancer treatment modality. So we're not set up to record that in our electronic medical record. What you can do is make sure you ask most of the questions on the Edmonton Symptom Assessment Scale or the Memorial Symptom Assessment Scale or any assessment scale. There's one study done a number of years ago that gave people a questionnaire about symptoms. It happened to be a 4-page long questionnaire, so it was too long. And then compared that to what they told the oncologist. And most oncologists come in and, like me, they'll say, "How are you? How are you doing?" "I'm fine. I'm doing great."
A polite patient wants to please the doctor.
They want to please the doctor. They don't want me to stop their treatment. They don't want me to realize how sick they are because they're afraid that I'll stop the treatment that is possibly maintaining their life. I've even had patients hide their crutches behind the door.
Goodness me.
Which doesn't work when I come in the room and close the door.
Mm-hmm.
So if you ask, "How are you doing?" you'll get one symptom. If you use a checklist like the Edmonton Symptom Assessment Scale or something like that, they found 10 symptoms that were significant, over half of which were judged to be serious. So you just have to ask.
I also think that it gives you the message that you are open to having that conversation. You are interested in knowing that, as opposed to this is either not important or not relevant or not welcome because you're just busy. So there's a certain signal to the patient that you can talk about supportive care and it's welcomed.
One of the most important parts that came out of Jennifer Temel's lung cancer study was a secondary analysis that looked at how often did the oncologist ask about coping and how often did the palliative care team ask about coping.
Mm.
And it's a simple question. You look the patient in the eye and you ask, "How are you coping? You're pretty sick right now. How are you coping?" And you give them time to answer. And then you turn physically, that's what I teach the fellows, you turn physically and look at the family and say, "Aunt Maud or your dad is pretty sick. How are you coping with his or her illness?" It's a really simple question. I can guarantee that no one has asked them that question before. In my multiple years of being a cancer survivor, no, the only person who asked me that was a dermatologist. And as they were burning a basal cell off my leg, and when I said, "Well, life's actually pretty crappy right now," he physically went back, physically rocked back, and said, "Well, let's see that spot in your leg."
Right. Change the topic immediately because this is alert, alert. The patient wants to talk about something difficult.
Yes. So it's a simple question. We have the Edmonton Symptom Assessment Scale embedded in our regular notes. And you don't necessarily have to ask every question, but you have to ask, "Are you bothered by depression? Are you bothered by anxiety? Are you bothered by shortness of breath? Are you bothered by nausea? Are you bothered by diarrhea or constipation?" You go through 10 or 11 things. And as you say, it lets the patient and family know that you're interested and opens up a door for conversation.
I have to put in an extra plug here for the Edmonton Symptom Assessment Scale, or ESAS, because our friendly Canadian colleagues have managed to translate it into every language on the planet except for Australian Aboriginal languages. We're working on that bit. But if your patient is not necessarily that good with handling English, you can download a one sheet from their website and you could use any language you like, which actually reduces this sort of gap in access for patients who might have limitations with language. And that's an incredibly useful, handy trick.
That's a great trick to know. The other part about Jennifer Temel's randomized trial of lung cancer patients, 157 of them at Mass General, which is a great place to get your lung cancer care, half of them got their regular care there and half of them saw the palliative care team. But if you look at the studies that came out of it, you can't just pretend that you're doing palliative care, just like you can't pretend that you're doing the same myeloma protocol that was published, I mean, you can't modify it by reducing the drugs down to 25% or 10%. The first visit was an hour with a palliative care nurse practitioner or palliative care physician, and they would bring in other team members as needed. And then every month after that, they would meet with the same expert person in palliative care for at least 30 minutes. So they would spend 15 minutes on symptoms. And then you have 10 minutes to ask about illness understanding and maybe preparation for what lies ahead. And then you have 5 minutes to discuss anything else. But most oncologists don't have an extra hour a month to give to patients. And if you're going to do palliative care like it was done on the trials and get the same results, you have to do it like it was done on the trials. Rami and I, again, and Arjun Gupta wrote a study, we followed Dr. Temel's studies from her first one to her second one to her third one, and it's a dose-intensity relationship.
Yes.
When you have expert people spending the time following a set protocol, you get great results. If you pretend that you're doing palliative care by asking, well, how's your pain? That's not going to get you much in the way of results at all.
You've just given me a bit of an epiphany here, because it occurred to me that this topic of time toxicity has just been raised as a concept very important for patients when they waste their time in the health system instead of living their life. But there is also another aspect of time toxicity. If we as healthcare providers do not give them time to address their needs, we potentially might be amplifying toxicities that otherwise we would have fixed, because we just don't have that time that is required for caring. And yes, many oncologists would have tiny little short consultations that invariably are running late and have this feel of time pressure. That's not the environment where we can do good supportive care, is that?
It is not. Speaking as a breast cancer oncologist, if I've got 15 to 20 minutes with a patient, it's all that I can do to assess how they tolerated the last chemotherapy, maybe go over the results of tests in the meantime, examine them quickly for toxicity that isn't evident, and discuss the next steps. To ask me to spend half an hour doing a formal symptom assessment, psychological assessment, spiritual care, calling the chaplain, getting social work involved, setting up a physical therapy consultation, I don't think that's reasonable for most oncologists.
Yes, yes.
I mean, you can take some advantage of some of the time that we waste. So if you have iPads with the Edmonton Symptom Assessment Scale, you can give them to the patients out in the waiting room. Or you can give them even a paper and pencil Edmonton Symptom Assessment Scale out in the waiting room, gives them something to do, and then they can bring it in and show it to you, and you can incorporate it into the medical record. And you sort of simplified the whole process.
So we can be smarter in how we use our time rather than just wasting the time or not taking advantage of opportunities that could be used better in how we deliver care.
Correct. You mentioned time toxicity, which is a relatively new concept. One that I'm particularly concerned about, especially in the States, is financial toxicity.
Yes.
Which is another part of ongoing long-term survivorship, which generally isn't a problem when you're having surgery for colorectal cancer and then getting 12 weeks of FOLFOX.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, almost every insurance company pays almost all of that. They pay for all the surgery, and you might have a 20% copay on some of the drugs, but you get through that and you're not going to be burdened by $100,000 worth of bills. But suddenly, when you're on your second or third line monoclonal antibody or targeted drug, each of which costs $33,000 a month, and sometimes you're using a BRAF drug and another drug, so you've got $60,000 a month of somebody has to pay. That's a huge burden.
Yes.
That we didn't anticipate, because I don't think we expected people to live as long as they are.
Yes, yes. But again, we're redefining the concept of what survivorship challenges are. They just go beyond the physical concerns or even emotional concerns, the financial, the practical, the existential. Connected to financial toxicity is ability to do what you normally do, whether it is your favorite job or your favorite hobby, that's also part of survivorship. And I think that those are important issues to survivors. As a cancer survivor yourself, what do you see as key priorities for us to address, both in healthcare delivery and research, that perhaps you know, stand out stronger now that you are a survivor rather than if what you observed as a healthcare professional who were not a cancer survivor?
Well, just one anecdote. You know, I used to be an ultramarathon runner, run 100 miles races. I've run across the Grand Canyon and back at age 55. And then I got significant pneumonitis with bicalutamide, one of my prostate cancer drugs. And my lung function dropped to 50 or 60% and really hasn't recovered very much. And that has changed my life immensely. And really, none of my healthcare professionals have sort of asked about, well, how has your life changed since you got cancer and got treatment? What things would you like to be doing that you can't do now? What side effects have you had that prohibit you from doing things that you love?
You know, I have a habit when I see patients for the first time in my clinic, I ask them, what do you do for fun? And I take note of that. And I kind of come back to that periodically just to see whether they're still doing it. And I get different answers. Some people say, I love gardening. Some people say, I love going to church. Some say, I'm a runner or a weightlifter or God knows what. And it's kind of, It's worth checking how that bit is going, because being an ultra marathoner may not necessarily be a question in an ESAS questionnaire, but it is important. So how do we get that captured? I think we need to really work on that challenge.
I think questions like you've mentioned are really good. I think asking what you do for fun, what do you do when you know you're not here in the doctor's office is always a good thing. Asking, are you getting out of the house? Are there things that you would like to be doing that you can't do now that we might be able to help? You know, maybe the person's depressed. Maybe they're profoundly fatigued and would benefit from some methylphenidate, or actually bupropion or Wellbutrin seems to work for fatigue in a randomized trial as well at very reasonable doses. Maybe we can help them with demoralization. Take a sheet of paper and say, write a list of problems you've faced in the past, and then write a list on the other side of top tactics you've used to get out of that deep hole. And then maybe try to draw some lines between the two. It's sort of cognitive behavioral therapy in an amateur way, but trying to say cope, don't mope, for people who were capable of of coping. You may be the first person who's told them, you really need to get out of the house once a day. I need you to walk for 20 minutes once a day just to humor me. It'll help your lungs. It'll help your brain. It'll help your intestines. Keep your muscles strong. Keep your bones strong. Just humor me. And for the next 3 weeks before our next visit, I want you to walk for 20 minutes a day. 10 minutes out, 10 minutes back. And then the next time I'll ask them, well, how did that go? And usually people say, well, it wasn't as bad as I thought it was.
Yep.
And then you can increase it to 45 minutes a day.
Yes. Yeah. There is a magic in writing a prescription for, you know, walking, running, having a coffee with your friend.
One of my colleagues and friends from Israel, Ben Korn, and his wife, Devorah, she's a family therapist. He's a radiation therapist and oncologist. They actually have a prescription pad, and it's a prescription for hope. And you put the first four lines are, what are you hoping for? And then what can you do to increase to meet those goals? What can your healthcare team do to help you meet those goals? We try to make sure that everyone on every visit gets asked, what are you hoping for? And in fact, we have these little sunflower buttons, and we try to remember to ask that question. It could be the medical tech person who's getting their vital signs can ask that question. What are you hoping for?
Yes.
Just again, to say, I'm interested in what you're hoping for because I'd like to help you accomplish those goals.
Yes.
We've given out tens of thousands of those little buttons over the past couple of years.
Truly, you have so broadened the perspective of what we can do in supportive and palliative care. And you've given me so many tips that I need to now go and apply in my clinic. It's been a fabulous discussion. I've got only one more question left, Tom, which I try to ask everybody, and that is, why do you think supportive care matters?
I would lump palliative and supportive care together. I don't care what you call it. Whatever works for you and the patient and family and the referring physician. You have to remember that our primary customer as a palliative care doctor or professional is not necessarily the patient. Our primary customer is the referring healthcare professional, whether it's doctor or nurse practitioner. It matters because people are sick. They have symptoms. They have emotional needs. They have stresses. Their family and caregivers have tremendous stresses on them. They might have time toxicity, as you mentioned, and financial toxicity that we're not aware of unless we ask. And in a short oncology visit, you simply don't have the time to do most of that. You can do some of it, and you can make the argument to lengthen the time of your visits. If you find that somebody is really struggling, make them a 30-minute visit rather than a 15-minute visit. But I think that the data are very clear from multiple randomized controlled trials in the outpatient setting with cancer patients and emergency room patients and pulmonary patients that having this other team of healthcare professionals work along with your primary team makes a huge difference in quality of life, symptom management, your stress and depression, and the stress and depression of your caregivers. And I think it's important to remember this is not just oncology. Dame Irene Higginson did a similar study, randomized trial with patients with breathlessness at King's College London. And at 3 years, the difference in survival was almost 15 people out of 100 when they had a palliative care intervention specifically for breathlessness.
It really reminds us how much more we can do and how much richer our role as healthcare providers could be if we pay attention to good palliative care and good supportive care. Tom, you've been a wonderful guest at this podcast. Thank you so much for all your tips. I know there are so many more things that I could ask, and I hope that we'll get to talk to you again because there is a wealth of information and wealth of very good practical tips that we can take advantage of. So thank you very much.
You're very welcome. I hope to get together soon, even in person.
Wonderful. That is all for Supportive Care Matters, a podcast created by me, Bogda Kozwara, for researchers, clinicians, policymakers, and patients passionate about improving the lives of people affected by cancer. Thanks to Mark Tai, who composed the original music, and the Oncology Network, our producers. For show notes, go to www.oncologynews.com.au. Subscribe to this podcast at your favorite podcast provider and rate us. It will help others find us.